So hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're going to be looking at, what we've called our presentation today is a flight to quality. And we'll run through some key areas of that. And we thought we'd just bring this to your attention. So we have done this similar topic about 12 months ago. We thought we'd just give it a light brushing over, I guess, essentially, and bring it into the now, but also particularly relevant given there has been a recent resurgence or move with a large number of large fund managers across to the quality side of stock selection. Agenda today, so we're going to be doing a quick quant recap. We're then going to be looking at the MSCI Quality Index and sort of the proponents and components of that. We'll then be looking at the way that Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund view quality, and also running through some areas where quality works and where it doesn't necessarily always work as well, before rounding out, as we always do, in looking at how these themes reflect how we run money every day here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. I'm joined today by our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Sorry, g'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
There he is. And we'll jump across into it. So we thought just quickly, and I guess the reason for the season is that recently the Executive Director and Global Market Strategist, Kerry Craig from JP Morgan, was speaking in Sydney. And he mentioned that they're actually exploring now, or doing a focus on the quality side of stock selection in the investments that they're doing, which I guess might indicate a couple of things. You care to share some thoughts on that one, Damien?
Look, I think I guess I wouldn't pick on one particular person in looking at this, because there is a big focus from a lot of people on terms of quality, and largely because quality has been such a great performer for the last few years. And so, you know, arguably for some, it's, you know, it's a little bit late to the party in terms of you generally have markets sort of separated into a few different parts, what you'd call value stocks, what you call quality stocks, growth stocks, are the three main groups. Mm-hmm. And there's always sort of a bit of a tug of war between which ones are performing at which cycles. And value in particular has had terrible performance for the last few years.
Right.
And quality has had particularly good focus. So there's sort of it's a little bit of a double-edged sword in terms of saying, yes, you do want to try and buy quality companies, but you want to make sure you're not paying too much for them. Mm-hmm. And you want to make sure as well that you switch to all of a sudden say, hey, quality's been such a great performer for the last few years, I've got to have some quality.
Mm.
Doesn't mean that you're actually just arriving right at the end of the cycle and you know, you
missed your window.
Exactly. Yep. You're buying the asset that just went up, as opposed to as opposed to actually finding quality. So I guess what I'm saying is there's definitely benefit in buying quality stocks, but you need to temper it very much with how much you're paying for it. It's not just a buy quality at any price and rely on that.
So it's got to be at the right price. Okay, sure. So we'll run into our quant recap. And so just by introduction, I guess it's probably worthwhile just breaking down the quant componentry perhaps, and then how quality works into that.
Yeah, sure. So when you're looking at quantitative methods, I guess the big thing to remember is that this isn't like a magic trick to beat the stock market. You know, they talk about the formula to beat it, and the issue is with all of these, they're just numbers, and you need to work out what's underlying the numbers. You need to work out what's changing in terms of the numbers, and also as soon as you create measures, companies then will try and change the way they report their numbers in order to make themselves look better.
Okay.
So you need to sort of recognize that it's a constant evolving battle in terms of saying, well, if you're trying to find good quality companies is important, but recognizing that the measures of what is a good quality company changes over time. And there's actually some pretty big changes coming in the quality space at the moment. And so and there's still not a lot of clarity in terms of how some of the how everyone's going to be dealing with these changes, and so I'll sort of jump into that a little bit later. So keep in mind that, you know, quant methods don't always work. The method, the what we're trying to do is find the ones that are going to work most of the time. So we're trying to use our quantitative methods to find good quality stocks that are basically trading on, say, with less volatile earnings or big wide moats, as Buffett would say, and if we're playing in that space, it's a safer space to play in. You're more likely to miss the big blow-ups.
Right.
But having said that, there's a it's not always the case.
Okay.
And there's some implicit assumptions as well that I'll sort of get into in a minute.
Okay, sure. So the number one question.
Yeah, every time I'm looking at quant methods, the first thing I want to know every time is, am I selling insurance to the rest of the market? And so there's a number of books out there. The Black Swan is by Nassim Taleb is probably the most well-known of these. And what it's talking about is saying there are a certain number of trading methodologies and quantitative processes where, in effect, you're selling insurance to everyone else. And selling insurance feels really good because every single day you make a little bit of money. And every day you make this little bit of money from selling the insurance, and you can just sort of turn around and go, look, I've had, 50 days of making money every single day. Isn't this great? And, I can taking it back to a simpler version. If I decide to sell home insurance to all my neighbors, every day I'm out there selling the insurance, and isn't this great? Look at all this money that's coming in. Money, 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 money. Next thing you know, there's an earthquake and a whole bunch of houses in my area, all fall down, and I've got to turn around and go, oh, just a minute. I made $1 million in premiums, and now I've got to pay out $10 million in
costs and promises.
Exactly. And that's the part of the insurance, is that it comes in one big hit on one day. And so, but every day when you're collecting the insurance, it feels like you're a genius. Look at this. I collect this money from everyone every single day. Or every month I'm getting this home insurance from these people and just money coming in. I mean, what a great business until the day it hits. And that's with these quant methods is the same process in terms of saying people might be trying to avoid certain risks or there's certain disconnects in the market.
Yep.
And they're happy to pay somebody. There's this little arbitrage profit that people can sit there and make and make and make and make and make until the day that's not there and they lose all the... And so
this is principally an active management style. You never, explore this in a passive sort of situation, because you do need to have the ability to say, okay, at this point, I'm happy to take my winnings off the table and avoid the catastrophic fall or something like that. Am I getting that right?
No. What I'm saying is as soon as I'm picking a quant method to try and use to give me this advantage.
Yep.
I want to know why I'm doing it and why it gets me the money in the long term.
Okay.
So let's flick to the next slide because it probably makes it a little bit more sense with this one. Is quality? So most quant factors are a measure of either mean reversion or no mean reversion. So quality, for example, is saying if I buy a high quality company today, it's earning above average returns on its capital that it's put in, and it's got these nice big margins.
Yep.
And I'm betting that that's going to stay a high quality company. And if that's the case, I'm going to make more money than buying low quality companies, because that company will keep reinvesting and and those reinvested profits will grow on themselves and compounding, and that stock will perform better.
Okay.
Than a low quality stock.
And so on a value metric then is a...
Value metric is actually the opposite. So that's saying there will be mean reversion. So I bought this stock and it's really cheap and it's not going to be cheap forever. At some stage it's going to increase in price, and that's when I'll make my money on that.
Okay.
And so when I'm talking about these insurance plays, I'm saying, well, what that it's about the reason behind it. And so there's certain quant methods, say momentum or other ones that... where you're basically just chasing the latest stock. Momentum is basically whatever went up last year will go up again this year.
Okay.
And you just keep buying that stock. And it actually works for decent long periods of time, and then all of a sudden reverses dramatically.
Okay.
And it's a little bit of that insurance side that you need to keep in mind that, okay, if I'm going to trade momentum, I'm selling insurance to the rest of the market.
Yep.
And one day there's going to be a payment day. And I need to make sure that I'm out of that stock
before
it happens, which, I'll make sure I've offloaded all my houses before the earthquake hits, which is a very hard thing to do. Whereas there's other strategies out there where quality, where we're saying, well, you're not really in selling insurance on it. What you're doing is you're making a bet that I can find companies that are of better quality.
Yep.
And then they'll do better in the longer term if I can buy them at the right price. Value is then a measure of saying if I can pick up stocks that happen to be cheaper than what they should be,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually they'll revert back to being what they should be, and that's where I'll pick up the value from it.
Okay, yeah, right, sure.
Growth is another one about saying, well, if I'm going to find high growth companies and buy these high growth companies, and when we say growth, it's actually stocks that are priced for growth.
Yep.
That growth will come through, and or they might do better than that, and that's actually that's often a losing bet. The growth side.
Okay.
So what tends to happen with growth stocks is people overpay for them.
Mm.
So they're priced in as if they're going to grow. So it's a Tesla, for example, priced in as if it's going to be fantastic forever. And at the moment, if it's not fantastic, if it's just really, really good, then the stock price goes down because it's not, it's priced to be fantastic.
Yep.
And so it needs to be, above fantastic before you're actually going to make more money on the deal.
Yeah, right.
So growth is from that side. And then I've got sort of some of the most common quant methods. So they were momentum, growth, value, quality. And the other most common one is low volatility, which is basically that it's sort of an interesting finding that if you find stocks that don't vary much, they actually often do better than stocks that do vary. And so it's a little bit of a quality factor, but
I was going to say it's probably a little bit of a couple of those themes blended into a low volatility, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. But let's move on to what's most commonly looked at. There's a number of quality indexes out there, and this is what most people use as their basis for saying high quality stocks or not high quality stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit technical, but I think it's quite interesting at this point, and it shows some of the dangers of smart beta, where you just say I'm going to buy a smart beta play where MSCI quality is a perfect example. There's a formula to spit out what is a quality stock,
yep.
And that's what they do. They jump out and they buy those stocks, and that's all they own. And then every 6 months or so, they rebalance their portfolio and put some in and take some out.
Right. Okay.
And there's actually a bunch of really major accounting changes going through at the moment, and it sort of shows where. And there's been a number of them over the last sort of 10 years or so as well that mean that what's quality today is not the same as what's quality 20 years ago.
Mm, okay.
Because of accounting changes, not because the stocks have changed, because of the way they report has changed.
And so just sort of peel back that a little bit. So from when you say accounting changes, what does that mean? So obviously you've got, analysts such as yourself use a set of books, set of data that comes out, and then so essentially the underlying data then changes because they have moved something across the balance sheet or something. Is that where you're going?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And so the types of things that somebody would look at, if you look at a particular ratio, say a debt to equity ratio in 2010, and then you look at that same debt to equity ratio, same company, everything's actually exactly the same in 2020, and you're going to get a wildly different number.
Yep.
Because the definition of what debt is has literally changed.
Even though the principal debt at the end, it's just been renamed essentially, and then therefore, okay.
Yes. So what's being accounted for in a balance sheet is, and this year is the year where the bomb is hitting and companies are making major, major changes. And so it's still only, there's only been a couple of companies actually report under the new, these new standards.
And how have they gone?
And so
big differences.
Oh, absolutely. From, massive differences. And we've known they're coming.
Yeah, sure.
But, it means that if you're running off a system that's like this MSCI quality index, which is, I have a formula for how I will calculate things.
Mm.
There's a lot of gray areas about what they're going to do and how they're going to treat these.
Okay, sure.
So we might jump onto the MSCI quality definition. So they basically say companies that have a high return on equity, which is basically your profit divided by how much divided by the book value of your equity,
mm-hmm.
stable earnings that are uncorrelated, strong balance sheets with low financial leverage are targeted for quality growth. That's their definition of it.
Right.
And then their official definition is they look at a Z score of three Windsorized fundamental variables, which are return on equity, debt to equity, and earnings variability. So
that sounds exciting.
Sounds good. Sounds technical. let's jump in quickly and just to see what they're really doing, because unfortunately you don't get it's not as exciting as it sounds, and there's bigger issues than what it sounds.
Okay.
So the first one, this return on equity. I've got a chart up on screen, but you don't need to see it if you're listening in. It's basically IBM's return on equity from 10 years from 2006 to 2016.
Mm.
And it shows them going from a 20% return on equity to a 100 and something percent return on equity over that 10-year period. Pretty much a straight line, a few little bumps up and down.
Yep.
But you know, it sounds pretty good. So IBM, that what it's effectively saying, this formula is that if IBM invests $1, they will get back more than $1 straight away within a year.
Yep. Every time.
Which is obviously not happening.
Yep. Sure.
This is part of that whole, you know, what's happening underneath it, and what was happening was IBM was changing from being a company that was a manufacturer to a service company. And so getting rid of lots and lots of capital, because far less being capital intensive being a service company.
Yep.
They also had buybacks and write downs and a whole bunch of other things that were affecting the bottom part of it, so the equity part. So they had this ratio where the equity was shrinking and they looked like they're earning these fantastic returns, but the reality was
they're breaking even. Essentially, perhaps on revenue.
Yeah, they weren't getting. They certainly weren't getting 100% return on equity. You know, as a marginal return, they were actually doing quite well.
Yep.
But nowhere near what the underlying numbers were saying.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Then you flip to the next couple of years, and you can see that it pretty quickly fell back down again.
Over 3 years. It took 10 years to get up there, and 3 years to get back down.
You know,
again.
as various other things happened, and capital raisings, and other, you know, other effects. So what I'm saying is return on equity is in theory a great measure because I'm trying to measure how much profit do you make compared to how much equity has been put in.
Yep.
In practice, companies know that that's what you're doing, but also accounting standards aren't designed to try and give you a stable and an accurate measure of what return on equity is.
Yep.
And so you get these spurious numbers where they shoot up and they shoot down. And so what that means is if you have a formula, which is the you know, the default formula from MSCI, which says I just buy companies regardless of, you know, if as long as they're high on this measure, I buy them.
Yep.
Then that's what you get. You get companies that some companies that do actually genuinely have really good returns on equities.
Yep.
And other companies that where the numbers have been distorted by different accounting factors.
They've gamed it.
potentially gamed it, but potentially as well. It's just this is what the accounting standard tells them to do, and so they're doing it. And
yep.
The fact that there's unrealistic numbers coming out the other end, and unrealistic ratios, is not their fault. They're just applying the accounting standards.
Yeah, okay. And so with the accounting standards, is there a degree of uniformity across the world, or you know, like so for say a quality index that was looking at an international versus just a national sort of perspective, or
it's been pretty good for a long time now. The US versus the rest of the world is a difference. So most of the rest of the world is on IFRS, which is the International Financial Reporting Standards, whereas the US has its GAAP accounting.
Okay.
And so there are some differences, but they're a lot less now than what they were 15, 20 years ago.
Right, okay.
So, there certainly has changed since the pickup of that. But it does mean as well, you know, some of that when you backtest some of these factors, and MSCI has sort of said, oh, look, if we go back, you know, 30 years, here's what our performance
this
would have
works.
Been.
Yeah.
Is saying, well, yes, but different people on different accounting standards means you get different numbers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, fascinating. Okay.
Debt. The next part of it's the debt. Now, this is so you're measuring debt to equity. So you have the same problem because it's the book value of equity. So the same problem we just saw for return on equity happens again.
Yep. Okay.
The other issue is it uses total debt. So that means that it's not netting off cash that the company holds.
Right, okay.
And the biggest issue coming up is this change in the change in accounting standards at the moment, where what's happening in as companies report for 2019 numbers, what they have to do is take any leases and report them back as a debt. Take the net present value of the leases and report it back as a debt. So, for example, if you're a retailer, you've gone out and leased all these stores and they've got, you know, 10-year leases and 5-year leases and all those different timeframes. You have to look at how much do you have to pay, take a net present value of that and report that on your balance sheet as a debt figure.
Well, as opposed to just the annual lease payment.
Just paying it annually every lease. Well, yeah. And then every year you'll depreciate some of it and some of it will be interest expense. Like there's a changes, your interest expense changes. Like there's a lot of changes going on. And nobody really knows how everyone's treating this. Like different, so there's a couple of major different data providers out there, Bloomberg, Refinitiv, S&P Capital IQ, FactSet, and they've all got slightly different interpretations about what they're actually doing to report this. The companies themselves, some people are bundling it all up and sort of not really breaking it out. And other ones are being quite clear about, well, this is the debt part, this is the non-debt part. And so I think most people have sorted out any of the debt covenants issues, but it does mean that if you're blindly using what is the total debt figure that comes straight out of the company balance sheet, and it's not entirely clear what each one's going to be doing, and then the debt will for a retailer will roughly double. The actual debt that they're on the hook to from banks doesn't change.
Yep.
So their bank debt or their customer debt doesn't change, but what appears in the balance sheet as a debt figure will double.
Yeah, well,
And then the other big ones like aircraft companies often lease, they have quite large leases of planes, and then you sort of, the more you go down the line, sort of depends upon, different companies will have lower amounts.
And so with that total debt figure, so to use an example, Apple, I think up until, a couple of years ago with the Trump sort of changes had hundreds of billions from memory sitting offshore, but could still have, pulled out some large size debt locally. Would that then say, okay, well, even though they've got enough to pay off their debt five times over sitting offshore because of tax reasons?
Plus the debt of several small countries as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so Apple's a great example of where a company with a big amount of debt, total debt, but their actual net debt was they had net cash. They had way more cash than what they did debt. And it's sort of like a tax reasons for keeping the money. Yeah.
Okay, fascinating.
So,
jumping to the next one, earnings variability,
which is sounds really technical. And so you basically want to say, if I've got this company where it's got steady earnings, then I want to be able to buy that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So how does MSCI do it? Well, they use a standard deviation of earnings growth, and you say, okay, well, that sounds fair enough. And then they say, well, we use four data points. And for anyone who's of any scientific basis, four data points and a standard deviation, the calculations weren't made to go together.
Yep.
Standard deviations are talking about, you usually need sort of 25, 30 data points at least to actually start having any confidence. And so
that N is too small.
That N is way too small. So the other thing is positive surprises are just as damaging as negative surprises.
Mm-hmm.
So you get some big increases in your profit, and all of a sudden it's saying, well, no, we don't like that company anymore. That's
right.
Too many increases in profit. We've got to throw that one out. So So that's the next one. The next one they do as well is what's called wins arising. Wins arising is a statistical method you use when you've got dodgy data and you want to get rid of some of the dodgy data. Effectively, you basically
top and tail it or something.
Top and tail, okay. You basically get 95% of the observations, and you get rid of your top 2.5 and your bottom 2.5, and you say, well, don't know what's happening with those ones, but we'll just pull that back and call it instead of being a really high number, we'll just pull it back and call it whatever the 90s,
fifties or
95th percentile lots.
So outliers, they shouldn't exist, so therefore they don't. Sort of thing.
Exactly. And so what often happens is the outliers is actually it's an indication of this dodgy data. All of a sudden, equity's gone negative for some companies or something like that.
Yep.
And so all the calculations are all wrong for that company.
Mm.
And so what do you do? Well, let's just pretend that didn't happen, and let's just pretend they were all right. But it was either the best or the worst in the class. So and usually it's the best. So it's those cases where you go, a return on equity number like our IBM's, creeps up to 100%, and the numbers go, well, that's crazy. We know they're not earning 100% return on equity. They're not investing $1 and getting a dollar back tomorrow.
Yep.
So let's just pull that back to the 95th percentile, which is 40%.
Okay.
And let's just pretend it was
It was like that.
40%.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Might be right. Might be wrong. For some companies, it is completely wrong.
Mm.
So
doesn't feel like a quality way to be rating quality stocks. But anyway,
no. So I guess where I'm coming back to with all of this is when you see these quality measures and people talk about quality stocks and what they're chasing, and there are ETFs out there that you can buy that are quality ETFs, and so they sound really good. You want to have a look under the hood and see what is really being done, because if it's just a blind throw the numbers in the calculator, grind the handle and see what comes out the other end. I don't have a lot of faith in that as a long term.
And that sort of leads you to sort of think, because one of the things with ETFs is, there's generally a preset formula per se, and whether or not CEOs game it to, you get fitted into it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other question is, Does that and it mean that if the following year they just readjust the, you know, or tweak the model, so to speak, to you know, chase a better quality stock, does that mean that, that prior performance figures are then truthful because you're using a different set of rules every year or every few years that you review it as well?
Yeah,
that doesn't sound right.
Absolutely. Well, and that's part of the problem with the smart beta side. I do really like the idea of getting low cost exposure to different factors. But it all comes down to what your formula is.
Mm.
And so, unfortunately, these things change over time.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Very good. We'll roll across into our perception of quality.
Yeah. So, I sort of break it into a number of different categories. The five key ones is an economic moat. And so, basically saying, look, are you making money now and have you made money in the past? There's a trajectory. So, about saying, well, how are you reinvesting money and are you actually making a return on that? Mm-hmm. And are you still increasing? So I'm not sort of constantly looking backwards and looking at how great things was in the past and trying to sort of and just automatically extrapolating that forward.
Sure.
Stability. So we do want to try and get some measures about stability. How do we get so that those how do we measure some stability without reverting to a standard deviation of four data points. Gearing.
How many data points do we use, just out of interest?
As many as we can.
Okay, sure.
The gearing is, to me, is a one-tailed argument. So if a company has a lot of debt, that's usually a bad thing. Too much debt it turns into a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Too much cash often is actually a bad thing as well.
Mm.
Like it's often a sign that the company's in an industry where
run out of things to spend it on.
Yeah, or the company's going to run out of money.
Yeah,
you know, they're losing money. They've got some huge project coming up, and they need that. You know, nobody would give them the debt for it, so they need to raise cash or whatever the case is. It's not an automatic. To me, gearing is not a two-tailed.
Mm.
So the way I tend to want to look at gearing is. Yes, I'll punish companies that have too much debt, but if you've got about the right amount of debt, then I don't want to make any effect. And if you've got too much cash, I certainly don't want to give you a positive for that.
Right.
So okay. Sort of going, well, let's make that a negative sort of knockout.
And so is that sort of, in essence, like a third party sort of indication that, you know, say the business model or whatever it is they're borrowing money for has been reviewed by somebody that's then, you know, willing to give them money in a way. Is that a signal? So
No. Because there's plenty of companies with dodgy business models that have managed to raise debt.
Okay.
And they're the ones you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, right, yeah. Sure.
So you're trying to say, well, I don't, you know, even though the company managed to raise all this money, they've now got too much. And so sometimes what ends up happening is, and it's a bit like you're, the home loan, you know, that's mm-hmm. the thing is as an equity holder versus the debt holder is saying, well, if I'm an equity holder in a house and the owner has a 50-50 debt to equity, so 50% of it's worth 50% of its debt, 50% of equity, and I own some of that equity.
Yep.
Then I don't really mind, you know, I'm not really too worried about if things start to go wrong, then my equity will shrink, but
it won't
go to zero.
Yep.
Whereas if I'm, say, an equity holder like the Australian taxpayer in one of Scott Morrison's new 95% home loans,
sure.
Then, you know, as an Australian taxpayer, you have a 5%
buffer.
Is it buffer? Yeah. In this, and it's not a 5%. Yeah. So property prices go down 5%. Now there's no equity left.
Yep.
And the debt holder gets it all.
Public's on the hook.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And so. It is certainly about making sure that gearing is it's a one-tailed sort of side of it.
Okay, sure.
And then corporate governance, you can get lots of warning signs from corporate governance. Sort of, there's a number of factors in there that I sort of look in terms of quality about saying, well, if you start crossing too many boxes in terms of not having independent directors and having shareholder voting that sort of does that benefits certain class of shareholders over other shareholders and you know, not enough diversity and, you know, you start ticking a bunch of different boxes and no, you know, not enough independent directors, you sort of hit a stage where you say, well, okay, it's also, you know, we really need to cut those out of the list as well.
What about things like CEOs parachuting out of the company and CFOs and
Yeah, you can get certainly some measures for people leaving and there's directors buying and selling and things like that. I think there's a number of studies have shown that the sell signals are are better than the buy signals in those cases.
Yep.
But there are, again, it's not, none of these are like a guaranteed one. It's basically saying, well, I've already got a, you know, the gearing's quite high. The earnings are a little bit unstable. Corporate governance isn't that good. And all of a sudden you've got CEOs starting to sell stock and CFOs leaving and stuff like that. You sort of, that's okay. Red flag. Okay.
Yep.
Might be fine, but if there's enough there,
enough evidence to support the sell case.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
You find those quality stocks. And these are the stocks that are going to help you when you do have big downturns. These are the stocks that will.
Well, that's right. We've got to wrap around into why we're looking into them. So we've got a shot up here of our from our portal. So this is some of the metrics
just
that we use.
Pulling out an example of how we use the quality. So I sort of have this quality measure, and I've got a histogram just of all the stocks, and sort of showing that this stock sits in sort of the 6th percentile or whatever of eighth. Quality, 8th percentile, sorry, of the quality measure, and then I put that on a scatter graph then as well. On where I sort of map against, you know, how high is the quality versus how high is the value, and where do I want to buy stocks?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sort of looking for that crossover where I can say, well, if I've got a very high quality stock, then I'm happy to pay a bit more for that.
Yep.
But if I'm looking at a low quality stock, then my tolerance to the stock getting a bit more expensive is very low, and
effectively this in a way gives you an ability to track sort of, okay, well, if I bought it, you know, at a certain part, and for those that are listening in, we'll have the chart pack in the show notes, but you know, we've got essentially the scatter graph with a green curve sitting down in the bottom left hand corner, which is effectively like our buy zone.
Yep. It's our cheap and high quality stocks.
That's right, the area that you want to be in, the ones you want to have in your portfolio, given other factors. Then as you start to move out, that starts to give you a reason as to say, well, you know, it's heading out in that direction. Is it time to review the stock and, you know, potentially lighten the load or get it out of the portfolio?
Absolutely.
Yep.
And then we break it down though, because the whole idea behind this, again, needs to be, I hate coming back to one number, and that's what I hate with about the some of these smart beta ones is you're like, oh, you're in the index or you're not, and I don't know. The numbers just told me to put you in, so you're in.
Yep, sure.
Whereas it's actually saying, well, why are the numbers telling me to put you in? So if I look at a stock and say, okay, well, here's an example of a particular one where I think this is Apple actually, where I'm saying, well, it's rated really highly on quality, but as I look through each of those measures, I can see that this one in particular it rates really highly on return on reinvestment, which is one of the sort of key factors that I want to look at is saying, well, what type of returns are they getting on for the money they invested this year and last year and the year before that?
Yep.
I don't sort of care as much about the money they put in 50 years ago.
Of course.
I'm more interested in the recent, you know,
the current management.
Yeah, exactly. how are you going at reinvesting that capital? And so that's sort of saying, well, it's breaking down and going, well, the reason why it's in there is because it's really high return on reinvestment and the earnings quality is quite high.
Mm.
And then I can look at these other measures and say, well, it's about average on a whole bunch of things. I haven't got any red flags on it. If I do, sometimes it's fine. Like there are stocks where it looks great on 3 or 4 measures, looks really bad on 1 or 2 other measures. Okay, we need to go in and make sure that on the measures it looks really good on, is that true?
Yep.
And the measures it looks really bad on, is there something there that would prevent it from going up?
Yep,
but,
sure.
But you really do want to know why and sort of get, you know, quality, earning quality is very important when you're buying stocks, but knowing why is the most important part.
And you've got some sort of key factors here. I think I can see 8. And I'll give you an example just for those that are listening. So we've got under the quality sort of banner, we've got return on reinvestment forecast, corporate governance, as we mentioned, price stability, gearing earnings, etc. Is there a sort of a weighting in terms? Do you favour some of these metrics over others?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the return on reinvestment's my biggest one.
Okay.
But I'll look at and everything's
on
different.
Why that one over others?
It's one of the hardest ones to measure actually as well. It's it's very hard for companies to fake it. Mm-hmm. Like I think there's some of these others you can get changes depending upon how they're accounting for different factors.
Right.
Whereas if you look quite closely as we do at across different ranges about how much money has gone into this company over this past little while, and not just equity but debt as well, and then what's come out in terms of dividends and other factors, because there are companies where the earnings might be going backwards,
and there's a bit of good money after bad sort of issue,
no, but But the company's also ripping all this capital out of it. Like they're actually sitting there going, you know, they had $1 billion of capital last year and then they paid out, you know, $200 million in buybacks and all these other things like that.
Mm.
And profits might have gone backwards a little bit, but you're like, look, they just reduced the capital size of the company by 20%.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I'm happy to have a company that's throwing cash back to shareholders and you know, but losing, having slightly lower profits is a great outcome.
But it's paying out the difference, so to speak, rather than losing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Rather than those companies out there that are continually adding more capital to it, the profits keep growing every year.
Yep.
But you're like, yeah, we increased profits by 20%, you know, per annum over the last 10 years. And you're like, yes, but you also increased, you know, your equity by 50% per annum over the last 10 years. And so, because you have to be buying things and raising more money for it.
It's a bit of diminishing returns in a way.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's trying to get back to the bottom of that, because that's where I find that you get the most, you know, you get the best insight into what companies are doing and the best quality companies.
Yep.
But
sure.
Having said that, there's all these other measures, earning stability, you know, the earnings themselves in terms of margins and factors like that. So that wide moat part.
Yep. Okay.
And the other one I wanted to show quickly is just this, a breakdown of what I look at in terms of trying to get down to the source of it. So this is I'm trying to remember the name of this one.
It's a great chart. I know. Yeah. It gets a point across beautifully. I don't know. Yeah. I forgot the name of it.
But basically it's stripping back from the, it basically strips back to get to how did the numbers, where'd they come from? So if something's changed at the end, so I've had a quality number that's changed, strip that back to, you know, what's the underlying number that's changed? What's the which factor? So I can see what's green and what's red, and where that's coming from. But let's jump on for the podcast listeners. So that you'll have to look at online.
Yep, sure.
So
it might just before we, all the charts that we had up there are actually taken from our client portal. So these are the metrics that are available to clients at Nucleus Wealth in the MB Fund by just clicking on any stock in their portfolio. It'll bring up those the analyst report. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Not sure we mentioned that, but anyway, on to economic moat.
Yeah, so economic moat, I sort of look at it as, you know, high margins, high returns, and are you good at converting your equity into cash flow? These are the sort of key things I think you should be looking at when you're going through quality. The next one, the economic trajectory, is coming back to the high marginal returns, you know, above average EPS growth, so earnings per share growth, and then how sustainable is that economic moat?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that is whenever we look at these factors, we also look at different time frames. So we say we have this blended version that spits out that quality metric you saw and all those charts. We also have ones that said, okay, let's ignore the latest numbers and let's just look at forecasts and see where does this company come out, and you get a different answer.
Okay.
And then we do another one where we say, okay, let's have a look at averages over longer periods. So we do sort of, you know, purchasing power parity adjusted numbers flattened out over sort of 5 years and things like that. So you get rid of sort of currency changes and things like that, and you look at it sort of average over 5 years for very cyclical companies, and you say, well, if I bought this company on just its 5-year average, what does it look like?
Yep.
And so the real answer is somewhere is a blend of what's happening right now, what's going to happen in the future, which is a bit more unknown, and some, you know, if you're at the bottom of the cycle, companies, the numbers will look really, really bad.
Mm.
But if you're at the bottom of the cycle, then that's the time to be buying.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
And vice versa, you don't want to be buying companies that are right at the peak of their cycle. Everything looks fantastic, great returns on equity and all these things like that,
just
because they are at the peak of their cycle. And when the cycle turns,
they go the other way.
Yeah. So looking at things on those three different time frames as well sort of shows up to say, okay, am I buying this company because I like it right now, or am I buying it because it's actually a cyclical company? And and then for those ones, you're saying, okay, well, is the cycle going to turn? Are we at the bottom of the cycle? What's, you know, could this be an extended one?
Yep.
And so those are it's really about coming back to saying, what questions should you be asking of the stocks you're buying?
Yep, sure.
Before
okay.
You sort of automatically assume they're high quality.
Okay, absolutely. Stability.
Stability, yeah. So this is coming back to, you know, how much stability can I see in earnings, cash flow, dividends, share price? Share price is what most of the smart beta things focus on. To me, it's a little bit of the share price is a bit of a second derivative of what's really going on, because the share price will be volatile if the underlying company's earnings are volatile, or they've got so much debt that, you know, the equity slice turns into this tiny little factor on top that will get really big or really small depending upon, you know, small changes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so Yeah, so coming back to that stability part is about looking at all those and sort of making sure that the measurement, the primary measure you see out there for the smart beta ones, you'll see that there's a bunch of people out selling low volatility funds. And it's basically a backward-looking measure saying, well, this hasn't been volatile over the last little while, and I'm assuming it's always going to be that way.
Yep.
And there's also a factor of that as interest rates have fallen, that's been great for low volatility stocks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, they've had this huge tailwind. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's been a great idea to buy these stocks as interest rates have been falling. But interest rates are getting pretty close to zero, pretty much around the world. And so...
does it still work?
If you're going to say, you do need to recognize that low volatility is great, but you've had a free kick over the last 10, 20, 30 years, pick your time frame, from falling interest rates. And so then you need to say, well, how much of it, the return came from that?
Yep.
And then how much of it was actually because of the investment characteristics of the stock itself?
And so what would be an example of a low volatility sector or company or something? Is there a poster
utilities.
Boy? Utilities, okay.
Utilities,
yeah. Sure.
And real estate investment trusts as well.
Yep.
So anything where the earnings are very stable, and particularly the utilities are the best one in terms of saying a lot of them are government regulated and you just, here's the return you will make. And if you're getting a 6% return a few years ago and then interest rates keep falling and now you're still getting 6% return on your assets, but you're priced at a lower because you're priced relative to government bonds.
Okay. Yeah, sure. All right. Fascinating. Jump across into financials. So, diving into the books.
The books, yeah. So, it's the appropriate gearing. So, that's again, that comes back a little bit to the earnings variability we were just talking about before. So, like try and get something where you can, you can get the, are you getting the earnings volatility? Does your earnings volatility match your debt? So, if you've got a utility, you can handle higher debt loads on it because the earnings are very, very steady.
Mm.
If you've got a resource company, you probably don't want too much debt because the earnings are very variable.
Okay.
And then there's a thing called CDS spreads, which is basically credit default swap spreads. So, companies, hedge funds and other traders will actually price companies on how likely they think they are to go broke.
Okay.
And that's a good signal as well for... where you should be looking and
looking
at changes in that.
Okay. Yep, sure. And just finally, so where quant works and
doesn't work. I guess we're coming to this from the point of view that you're looking at the market at the moment and saying I want to find some stocks that are high quality so that I can protect myself if there's a market downturn.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think you do need to do is this return disaggregation I was talking about where we were saying, well, if I'm buying low volatility stocks and interest rates have fallen, how much of it comes from one and how much of it comes from the other?
Mm.
There's this overfitting and self-serving bias that people have about saying, well, everything that happens that was good was my fault and everything bad is unlucky. you need to have your numbers sort of coming back to saying, okay, well, how much of that really, where you just got lucky in your investments or some of these quality companies where they might have been high quality, like say a Google or an Apple or something.
Yep.
And then there's been this huge run up in the whole market and they've sort of been the leaders and been pushed away with it and saying, okay, well, how much of this was genuinely because the company was good quality and improving its earnings,
mm-hmm.
and how much of it was that the market actually fell in love with this stock at the point and pushed it way higher than it should have gone.
Right. Yep, sure.
And so the big issue though is when you're looking for quality stocks is keep remembering you're making a bet on non-reversion. So you're saying that, I'm buying this stock because it's high quality mm-hmm. and it will always be high quality, or at least for my investment horizon, it will continue to be high quality.
Yep.
BlackBerry, Nokia are stocks that were very high quality and then turned and were no longer high quality as people fled their products.
Good example.
And so Apple is a great example of sitting in that. If you're buying Apple because it's a high quality stock and we own it for that reason, you need to be keeping a close eye on the whole BlackBerry Nokia thing where, all of a sudden competitors popped up and better products and next thing you know, the market share went to close to zero. Yeah, exactly. And so knowing that for a stock like Apple, that can happen.
Mm.
So I need to be wary and on top of that.
Yep.
And that's my biggest risk in terms of buying quality stock is what will revert.
Yep, yeah, fair enough. And also when they keep bringing out $5,000 iPhones or something, do you think that will be the indicator? Time to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Plenty of profit.
picking some sectors in particular where quant doesn't work as well. or it certainly works differently.
Yep.
Resources. There's an old saying out there: you buy things on a high PE and sell them on a low PE. It's sort of like the inverse of
A mining stock
of the rest of the market.
Okay,
and so you need to take into account that resources are very cyclical. They're very reliant on prices that the company has no control over.
Mm-hmm.
So a company. And in terms of investment decisions, most mining companies, even the big ones, only make a few, major decisions, every decade.
Yep.
In terms of saying, do I go and open this, this massive mine and spend all this capital,
mm-hmm.
or don't I? They make a very few of those decisions over courses of years. And so, when you say, oh, I'm investing in good management in those companies and their ability to deploy capital at the right times.
Mm.
We don't know whether they can deploy. We've had two or three chances at looking at whether they have deployed capital.
Yep.
And then you have to go back 20 years to see the time before that. And that was a completely different board and completely different management anyway. And so.
Yeah, sure.
And
also, as you say, macroeconomic circumstances that lift or fail lift or depress the prices of what they're selling.
Absolutely.
Regardless of, whether or not they can sell it. So.
Yeah. If you're an iron ore producer and, the long-term cost is going to come back to $50, $60, which is where most people think it probably will. If you're producing it at $70, you might have managed to make a mozza while the iron ore prices ran up to $200, a few years ago.
Yep.
And then you started losing money and now you're back making money again. Mm. So, and is that your fault?
No.
That was what you had. You have a resource that's, you can probably, with most resources, it comes down to how much is in the ground, how deep it is, and how concentrated it is.
Good quality, yep.
And so, once companies have those assets, they don't change those. So if your cost is $70, maybe if you're good, you can get it down to 65 maybe.
Yep.
But really, you can only tweak at the edges.
Yep.
You're reliant on the price.
Mm.
Utilities has a number of other factors. You need to be quite careful about what's in those and how they're positioned, particularly ones that own slices of all these other companies. And so they might own 25% of an airport here and 10% of a railroad there and 80% of a highway. The question on those is saying, okay, how is it being reported and is it coming up the same way as others? And so you get some biggest differences we see is in stocks and utilities where they're thrown up as being fantastic companies, but it's the way they're reporting rather than the way they're
fascinating.
The underlyings.
Yep.
And then
financials.
They're a lot more difficult. Probably don't have enough time to go into the full bit, but financials are completely different ratios, and so often it's hard to compare them with the rest of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one I just want to highlight is sort of this manufacturing versus services. I've got about another 10 slices to this that I tend to look at, but it is very important to knowing what is the company actually doing that you're investing in, because if you're looking at a manufacturer or you're looking at a pure service company, as we saw with IBM. Before, you can get some very different ratios just based on the type of company it is, and they can, as they change over time or what have you, you can get the quant signals can send you some very wrong signals about what you should be doing.
Yep. Okay. Sure thing. And just to wrap up, so it is a tool. It's not a religion.
That's right. Yep. Yes. So so the big things for you're out trying to find quality stocks at the moment to protect your portfolio. Look deeper, I guess, is the answer. And this accounting standards changes is going to be a big change over the next few years. So I would say for anyone who's blindly buying an ETF that's a quality-based ETF, you'd want to be having a very close look at what are they actually doing, if anything, because I think there's a number of them that were pretty much going to sail into this as saying, well, this is what we've used for the past 10 years. We'll just keep using it.
Fascinating.
And so, that last point, though, don't lose sight of what you're really trying to do. When you're trying to buy quality companies, you're trying to use the numbers to dig in and find companies that are stable and steady and are going to keep, making these high returns. Don't sort of let the numbers don't let the tail wag the dog on the numbers all of a sudden determine what's a quality company and what's not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Keep your eye on the price.
Because the numbers are can be manipulated.
Yeah, sure. Okay, great notes. Well, a quality wrap up there on all things quality. Thank you very much, Damien. We'll jump across to what's coming up next week. So same bat time, same bat channel, Thursday the 18th of July, 12:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be looking at rates to zero and beyond. So obviously with the RBA cutting rates recently to the point where our regular cohort, David Llewellyn Smith, had a break this week, I think, just before he can gear up again for the blog for the rest of the year. So he will be joining us for that one. And you can, of course, catch that on the Nucleus Wealth live webinar page available through nucleuswealth.com. And on that note, well, that's it for now. And thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.